Please, you don't have to fly back, mate. But we have to sit in.
I guess the one.
Yeah. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Whenever you are ready, we're just waiting on you guys now. So whenever you're ready to start, we'll start. The sisters can come over to Hall A. We have the partition back up. So if you want to come outside, sisters, you're more than welcome to.
People need their tea.
All right, question number one. If for some reason they feel extremely shy and want to write down their question, they're more than welcome to. But you're going to have to wave at me to come give you the pen to write it so we'll know who you are. So it doesn't make any difference.
Assalamu alaikum. Question for the panel, doctor, is, my understanding is the way I see the world politics going on is whatever future relation between United States and the Republican of Iran is influenced by Israel. I believe it's every problem occurring in this world is no doubt that Israel is after it. There is some attempt to build the relation between the Republican of Iran and the United States, but the Israeli government came in between. What is your opinion in this matter? Assalamu alaikum.
I think everyone heard the question, so we're not in any need of repeating it. Yes, the Israeli nation state has a tremendous influence over the American government, especially when it comes to the Muslim world. It's always been one of these arguments of how substantial is the Israeli interest here in the United States vis-a-vis the government itself. Is the American government free to make its own decisions when it comes to its relationship with countries in the Muslim world? Or does it have to have Israeli clearance for the type of relationship and the strength of the relationship with countries in the Muslim world? And there's ample evidence that in this particular matter, now, as far as American relationships, let's say with Australia or with Canada, there might not be any significant Israeli input in this type of relationship. When it comes to American foreign policy towards the Muslim East, then this is where the Israeli lobby referred to by some people as the Jewish lobby in the United States, exerts tremendous pressure on the American government. Tremendous meaning means almost 99% of the decisions that are made by the United States State Department have to be cleared basically by the Israeli interest. You've seen in the past month how the contenders for the presidency of the United States, those three stooges, McCain and Hillary and Obama, how they had to appear in Washington, D.C. at the yearly AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, and give their speeches in which they expressed undying sympathy and support for the Zionist entity. The lawmakers in the United States, the congressmen, they know that if they want to get reelected, they have to rubber stamp the policies that are favorable to the Israelis. Very few of the congressmen can stand up and express themselves as they know or as they feel towards the conflicting interests of the Israelis and the Muslim world. Take, for example, one congresswoman, Cynthia McKinney, from the state of Georgia, who spoke out against what the Israeli government is doing to the Palestinians and made her position very clear. She's no longer a congresswoman. And this can be said about a few other congressmen. Paul Finley was an early one, Paul McCloskey, and a few others who expressed themselves very clearly on the issue of Palestinian rights and how they were no longer reelected to office. There's an army almost of American diplomats who are Zionist. Some of them are Jewish. Some of them are just Christian, but Zionists, which leads us to the other important dimension in American politics, and that is the evangelical Zionist Christians. There's a very strong Zionist Christian movement in this country. Estimates vary between 50 and 90 million. I've seen it up even to 100 million who consider themselves to be evangelical Zionist Christians, or evangelical Christians who are in support of Israel. You have, you know, such figures as Pat Robertson and this guy here in Texas, Hagee, who unflinchingly give sermons and talks in support of Israel. They're more Zionist than some of the Zionist Jews themselves. When Ariel Sharon and the Israeli government decided to relinquish Gaza, Pat Robertson said that, you know, this is going to incur the wrath of God on the state, on the Jews in the state of Israel, because they're giving up part of biblical Israel. They have no business doing that. They have no right doing that. So add to that the incompetence and the sycophancy of the rulers in the Muslim countries. They don't have a backbone to stand up to American prejudice for Israel. And you have almost a 100% foolproof policy, American foreign policy, in support of Israel. And that automatically translates into antagonism and hostility towards the Islamic Republic in Iran. Almost everything that is supportive of Israel is hostile to Islam. And because the Islamic State in Iran is on the front line of the Muslim world and the Muslim countries, it stands to take the brunt of the pressures that are coming out of the United States government and European governments that act as a frontline defense for the Zionist occupation of Palestine.
Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. I have a question for Imam Al-Asi that recently in the Middle East, America is trying to create a so-called Sunni front against, they try to create a sectarian dimension against Iran. But on the other hand, we are seeing that, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia is showing some, I just want to ask you, what is your assessment of King Abdullah's, behavior or how he's working? He's one time showing, inviting Iranian leaders and trying to give a signal or message or what? I just want to, your opinion about that.
He's talking about that conference,
King Abdullah, as is the case with the other kings and princes and presidents and dictators in the Arabian countries, they have a margin of diplomacy that they are allowed. The United States imperialist policies, as well as the Zionist policies, they don't permit freedom of political Islamic expression. And so if there's going to be a conference that Abdullah is going to convene in Arabia, bringing together Muslims from around the world, there's nothing that in the manual of imperialism and Zionism says that you can't have conferences. They've been having these conferences all along, and the conferences don't seem to be of any substance. They really don't get down to the nuts and bolts of the issues that Muslims in a mature and responsible way should be discussing. They massage each other's egos and they say fine words and they express platitudes and everyone goes home and nothing has been accomplished. So there's no dent that has been done to imperialism or Zionism by these conferences. Add to that the fact that just before the official Saudis held the conference, there was a religious document in the internet that was signed by around 20 of the top Saudi scholars that were cautioning Muslims all over the world of an imminent danger, a lethal threat to all of the Muslims. And when you're reading that, what are they going to say? They're going to talk about Israel? No, they're talking about Shia'i Muslims. And to me, more particular and more to the point, they were speaking about Hezbollah. The Saudis are very concerned about Hezbollah. Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, when he comes on TV, it's like when they have the World Cup. People are mesmerized to the TV. You can sense it in the streets. There's not many people around in the shopping centers or in public areas. They're listening to what he has to say. And the Saudis are very sensitive to this because it is sort of, in their own minds, taking away from their popularity and eroding their legitimacy. So they're trying their best to now realize the Saudis have no problem with the type of Shiites who are in Iraq who are working in tandem with the United States. These are buddy buddies, these are fraternal friends, these are co-religionists, and these people are, these are their brothers. But when it comes to Hezbollah, who have astonished the world and defeat the Israelis for the first time. They are the first fighting force in the Middle East. Even by the confessions of high-ranking Israeli generals and military personnel that since World War I, Hezbollah is the only fighting force that is in that area. Hezbollah managed to accomplish what all the Arab governments and armies failed to accomplish throughout more than half a century of off-and-on wars. So Hezbollah is, in the Saudi political lexicon, enemy number one. And Israel takes a back seat compared to Hezbollah. So let's not be deceived by political gimmicks of conferences here and there. They permit, or the Saudis are permitting or thinking about permitting the Jews to come back to Arabia. The Jews who had left Khaybar and al-Medina, there have been talks many years ago dating back to the 1980s when Bandar ibn Sultan was the Saudi ambassador in Washington. Contacts between him and some American Jewish officials, the discussions led to some type of opening up of the subject of Jews who are originally from Arabia to go back to Arabia, to their original homeland, to their original homes in Medina and in Khaybar. At the same time, they are saying that Hezbollah, and remember Hezbollah, they are disturbed by Hezbollah because Hezbollah is carrying the ideas and the spirit of Imam al-Khomeini. May Allah have mercy on him. And so they're disturbed by that. They don't want that to happen. But if some other types come along and they want to play diplomacy and they want to have good relations with the Saudis and all of this, then, you know, Saudis don't have any problems with that. Let me also mention that not much of the heard about news, news that doesn't circulate, in other words, after this meeting, this conference that you're referring to that took place in Arabia, sponsored by the Saudi government, convened by King Abdullah, attended by officials and scholars from the Muslim world, its objective is to go beyond having Muslims meet, to take its steps forward and have a type of understanding and reconciliation and sincere interfaith discussions between Muslims on one side and Jews and Christians on the other side. This is at a time when the Saudis don't have it within themselves to sponsor in a systemic way. This is one conference and it's done for political mileage, but there's no principled and programmed conference to bring Muslims together and to have Muslims, just like, as is the case in the Islamic Republic of Iran, where there's Majma' al-Taqrib Bayn al-Madahib al-Islamiyah, the international forum for the approximation of the Muslim denominations that has had for 21 years now a principled program that opens its doors to Muslims from the different denominations and different theological backgrounds to come and meet and express themselves to themselves, by themselves, without any hidden agenda. And as I said, the news that doesn't circulate is that the United States was so incensed that Mr. Rafsanjani went to Saudi Arabia that it began expressing in some of its media outlets, American mass media, why is Saudi Arabia giving visas or permitting some Iranians to go to Saudi Arabia when some of them are wanted by Interpol and by international law. So that didn't sit very comfortably with imperialist Washington, which means in the future there's probably going to be some type of conditions if the Saudis ever think about having a routine conference convene from year to year or on a scheduled basis.
There was a question that a brother wanted to ask you. He's written it down.
Okay, this question says, if the U.S. withdraws from Iraq, are the Iraqi people ready to govern themselves, i.e. Al-Qaeda, Taliban, Sunni civil war, Shia? You've been reading too much Western jargon. Any people are ready to govern themselves. They may have difficulties. At the beginning, they may have some serious differences, but they have enough maturity and they have enough camaraderie to work their problems out. I think the civil war is because there's an occupation there. If this occupation goes away, then the conflict is going to dwindle. It might not happen overnight, but eventually it will happen. But as long as the occupation is concerned, American policy is to have Sunnis kill Shiites and Shiites kill Sunnis and Sunnis killing Sunnis and Shiites killing Shiites and Arabs killing Kurds and Kurds killing Arabs. They'll do everything that is possible to ignite any potential differences between any segments or categories of the Iraqi people or other peoples across the borders. That's the way they operate. But if they withdraw, yes, there might be a time of transition which will have its ups and downs. It's going to demand some serious efforts. But eventually they can put their house together and they can go on becoming another building block in the resumption of a larger Islamic order in the world.
I'll ask you on the same subject, you know, like the, you know, I'm just, I know, but I'm just it's like a devil's advocate type thing. Like people say that there was a good, you know, Islamic resurgence in Afghanistan when Russians were there and there were, you know, Islamic parties. When Russian left, they start killing each other and they never have a, you know, so... To me, it seems that there was lack of leadership, a single leadership like Imam Khomeini has done in Iran. But in Afghanistan, they have, you know, general Muslim public has a idea, like for 10 or 15 years, they were fighting, Hikmatyar fighting this, and, you know, Abdus Sayyaf and this and that. So people are, seems to be, some people are worried about similar situation happening in Iraq.
There's a difference between Iraq and Afghanistan. The difference is that when there was a Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, all the Afghani people were against that Soviet occupation. All doesn't mean 100%, but it means the overwhelming majority of people were against that foreign occupation. Therefore, there was a struggle against the Soviet occupation. That struggle was tainted because there was an American hand in that struggle, and then the American hand has been playing itself out through the Taliban and now through the Karzai government. Both of these are two sides of the American presence in Afghanistan. When you come over to Iraq, the majority of the people of Iraq at the beginning of the American occupation of the country were not anti-American. They thought that the American presence in Iraq is going to free them from a dictatorship and a tyranny, and then they can turn the page and begin a prosperous and a progressive form of government in which all the people are going to participate and Iraq is going to become a model of governance in the area. It turns out that that wasn't the case. The American occupation once again proves what it really is. It's an occupation. It's not a liberation force as they presented themselves. So they want things done their way. Recent discussions tell us that the Americans are insisting on having 50 military bases inside of Iraq. And here's where the Iraqi people are beginning to become like the Afghani people were when they objected and fought against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. Now, are the Iraqi people going to be like the Afghanis who, in their struggle against the Americans, are going to have a hidden agenda, like the Americans had a hidden agenda in Afghanistan, working through different so-called jihadi groups against the Soviet invasion? I don't know who can play the equivalent of the United States in Afghanistan inside of Iraq. Who is going to be the force that's going to come inside and help the Iraqi people liberate themselves from American occupation? China? No, I don't think so. What other foreign major power in the world is going to play that role? Yeah, but that's not if the Islamic Republic has a hand in the internal affairs of Iraq, it's going to be a brotherly hand. It's not going to be a state that has a hidden agenda and is playing with the Iraqi people for its own national interest, the way the United States was acting in Afghanistan. Now, these are two different scenarios. People who think that these are unfolding or can potentially unfold in very similar ways, they really don't have their political facts together.
There's a brother that was waiting for a while.
Assalamu alaikum, brother, and thank you very much for your enlightening speech. Let's go back to the ayah that you brought, that لكل قوم هاد. That may partially explain to some people that why the other nations didn't follow the leadership that was going on in Iran. Therefore, what happened in Iran was limited to the borders there, the change. The question I have is, who was the role model of Imam Khomeini? As you know, it was Prophet Muhammad. Was his role model. Even when he chose the name of his children, he called them the names of Muhammad and his daughter Zahra. So he got everything, if anybody is familiar with Islamic history, from Prophet Muhammad, the way he approached the amnesty, everything. So there is a role model in the Islamic world that is the Prophet Muhammad and the way he approached things. And Imam Khomeini copied it and applied to the constraints of the time, of course. Now, my question is, what is missing in the Muslim world? They have Prophet Muhammad. They have an example like Imam Khomeini. Yet, they are so stagnant. They haven't done basically anything to change their condition. So there seems to be something seriously missing there that doesn't let them go.
The next question is mine, after the sister.
You know, this is a very simplistic approach to a long, drawn-out struggle that the Muslims have been having against internal enemies and external enemies. Of course, Imam al-Khomeini is probably the closest we have had in our lifetime of the exemplification of the Prophet's overall character. There's no doubt about that. Any dwelling on this belabors the issue. The component of your inquiry pertaining to the other Muslims, where you say there's something missing, you know, this type of thought you have to rid yourself of. When people are fighting in Muslim countries, and they've been fighting for the past 300 years, if not in the past 1,400 years, there's a history of a struggle. The problem with this struggle is that many times it's been hijacked by those who steal power. This we have been familiar with at the beginning of our history, and it continues to repeat itself even in our lifetimes. The first example is Muawiyah stealing power. That's the first example. The last example you have is the rulers of Arabia who are still stealing power. And the peoples that they govern, they don't govern with their consent. Muawiyah did not govern with the consent of the Muslim peoples. Abdullah in Saudi Arabia doesn't govern with the consent of the Muslim peoples. This is a general rule you can extend from Morocco to Mindanao. And don't be as simplistic as to say, and I'm not talking to you personally, but I know there's a notion in the Muslim mind out there that always wants to judge Muslim peoples by the thieves who steal power illegitimately in the absence of Islamic freedom to express itself. If that Islamic freedom was available early in our history, we wouldn't have had the type of political deterioration that we've been living with ever since then. So let's give credit to Muslim people who are on the front line, giving their lives, and then eventually this is going to wind up with their liberation, both from the external enemy that has been occupying and invading, and the internal enemy that has been stealing and usurping power. Eventually that day will arrive. But if we begin to take an inter-Islamic position that, you know, I have something other Muslims don't have, just go live with those other Muslims you think. Live. I would invite these people who speak and think like that, I would invite them to go to South Lebanon and to Gaza just for 4 weeks only to cleanse this holier-than-thou attitude.
My question is, how do we deal with Israelis who are here at workplace? They could be co-workers, they could be customers, they could be parents of children at school. So do we just ignore the fact, or do we have to do something about it?
The sister used the word Israelis. The word Israelis has a very hostile meaning to it. And if you mean Israelis, you don't mean Jews, and you don't mean just the average person who may feel, I'm talking about American, the average American person who may be misinformed and feels some type of sympathy towards Israel. If you don't mean these, if you just mean Israelis, meaning individuals who have Israeli citizenship, and therefore most of these individuals have served in the Israeli armed forces, and therefore most of them have seen action against innocent people, Palestinians in particular, Maybe they've killed, maybe they've maimed. Who knows what they have done? If these are the types of Israelis that you are talking about, well, you should be very cautious, very alert, and on guard concerning them, because they harbor animosity and they harbor hatred towards Muslims. They turn around, they say, we Muslims hate them. I wish we Muslims could hate them at the same degree and intensity that they hate us. I wish that was the case. The fact of the matter is, no, they are the ones who know how to hate, and therefore they kill disproportionately. And they've been in the business of doing that. And they show no qualms or no second thoughts about it. They don't want to sit with those that they consider to be their adversaries or their enemies. They want to go in with bombs, drop these types of explosives in civilian areas, killing innocent people. And right now we have Gaza, a population of 1.8 million Palestinians that are virtually in a concentration camp. And the Israelis, you're asking your question about Israelis, they haven't expressed in public, as far as we know, any formidable opposition to the Israeli government that is doing all of this, if not they themselves have been participants in this, because they serve military duty, it's mandatory upon them, and then once they are dismissed from the mandatory military duty, they are called up for reservist duty every year. And some of them, they are dual American citizens, American Israeli citizens, and some of them here in the United States are in very high positions indeed. Many of the neoconservatives, even the head of Homeland Security, his mother, his parents set up the Israeli intelligence service, the Mossad, at the beginning of that nation state. And this person is said to be a dual citizen. He has American-Israeli citizenship.
Chertoff?
Really? Yeah. So these are the types. I mean, they're no friends. Don't mistake. Don't play games with yourselves. Don't mistake them. They are no friends. قَدْ بَدَتِ الْبَغْضَاءُ مِنْ أَفْوَاهِهِمْ وَمَا تُخْفِي صُدُورُهُمْ أَكْبَرُ قَدْ بَيَّنَّا لَكُمْ. Hatred and animosity is expressed by their words, by their choice of words, by their language. Yet what they conceal inside of them, in their bosoms, is more severe than what they express. We have shown you this. We have brought this to your attention. قَدْ بَدَتِ الْبَغْضَاءُ مِنْ أَفْوَاهِهِمْ وَمَا تُخْفِي صُدُورُهُمْ أَكْبَرُ قَدْ بَيَّنَّا لَكُمْ. But once again, that's if we have our eyes opened and we're listening and hearing what's going on. But what do you do if we have communities, Muslim peoples, who are in deep coma? What do you do with them? That's our problem.
I think there's a big, I sometimes feel there's a disconnect here in America and other Western nations with Muslims. They don't perceive Zionism as an existential threat to themselves, which it obviously is, because if you look at any of the polemics that are going on against the Prophet Muhammad, all the way from Holland, anywhere, you'll see a Zionist, very apparent Zionist hand. If that person themselves isn't Jewish Zionist, you'll see a Zionist hand in that. And I think that stems from Israel's recognition that the true threat to its existence is Islam, the true Islam that tells Hamas that they cannot acquiesce and that they should stand firm, like the Quran says, and then they will succeed, and they are, because over 70% of the Israelis now, the Haaretz was reporting, 75% of Israelis want a truce with Hamas. Or there are secret negotiations going on with Hamas for a truce. In other words, the Israelis are acquiescing to Hamas. You know, and the Hamas is now in a position of leverage in negotiations. But people in America and England don't see them as an existential threat to themselves. And how do you How do you convey that? That if they had their way, the Zionists, Islam in America in the next generation would be gone. That's what their plan is. They are against Islam itself, against the, you know, against Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah, it's a very good demonstration of how deep and how vicious the Israeli Zionist animus is towards the Muslims. At the same time that they are subjecting a population to a policy of genocidal proportions, that's the Palestinians. Can you imagine? No electricity, no power, no gasoline, no food supplies, no medical supplies, and this thing continuing on and on. And then they, in the background, the Israeli interest has a chokehold on the Arabian governments, who otherwise would be able to offer a hand of support, but that's not even possible. At the same time that they are doing this, they are behind this campaign in the West to vilify and to lampoon Allah's Prophet. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his. So, you know, this demonstrates the extent at which they are operating, the depth in history, the current broad spectrum of hatred towards just a resurgence of Islamic self-determination. Remember, Muslims don't have armed forces that are occupying the oil fields of Europe and the Americas. The Muslims don't have a naval presence, a naval armada in the Gulf of Mexico or on the shores of California. It's the imperialist U.S. Armed forces and government that have their bases. There's, depending on how you define a base, because it could be a base, it could be a military installation, it could be a lookout post. But if you have a general definition of all of these being American bases in the world, the United States has 1,000 military bases in the world. Probably 3/4 of them are in and around Muslim countries and territories. And if we don't speak about this, if we can't begin to think the meanings, the ayat, and the quotes of the Prophet, if we can't begin to think these out in relation to the realities of this life around us, obviously we're going to limp from one disaster to the other. One decade, the Muslims suffer in Kosovo and in Bosnia. The following decade, the Muslims suffer, tremendously in Iraq and in Afghanistan. In all of these decades, the Muslims have been bleeding in Palestine and in Kashmir. And this goes on and on. When is the time going to come for us, and I hope it's sooner rather than later, when we can understand what Allah is telling us, and when we can pinpoint a Zionist and an imperialist when we read Allah's book? That's the disconnect. We read al-Yahud and the Nasara, and we think about them as Jews and Christians. Every time we read these words in the Quran, but in the context of the Quran, the ayat, they qualify and they fine-tune these words. So al-Yahud and the Nasara, in ayat in the Quran, they mean the political expression of the Jews and the political expression of the Christians. It happens to be in our time, as far as the Jews are concerned, Zionism. And as far as the Christians are concerned, imperialism. So we have to open up our mind and conscience on these two realities, and then consolidate ourselves, and then put an end to their troublemaking, not only in our lands and territories, but in our minds and in our psyches also.
Assalamu alaikum, doctor. Doctor, I have a trouble, an issue really troubled me for maybe 4 or 5 years. Some of the Iraqis living here, they go out. They set places scattered all over the United States, like translation, or they set up like a camp, or they make small town, like small village, similar in Iraq. They go out there and they help them, and they actually, every 3 months they come in, like troops, they teach them, and they learn pretty much the tradition or culture of Iraqis, so prepare them when they go to Iraq. And some of them from here, they went inside Iraq. I mean, so far, I just don't understand what it's went wrong with the Iraqis. They pretty much, they sell in their countries. I mean, there is no more iman, there is no more faith. So we live in for, we just look for money. And everywhere I go, I raise the question. So it troubled me. So I really respect your opinion, Doctor.
As is the case with populations, you have a good component and you have a bad component. And the type of Iraqis that you just spoke about are the bad components of the Iraqi population. And some of them have sold their soul to the devil. Some of them are just basically hardcore materialists. They looking for their own interest. And some of them, they just want to survive on their own terms. To them, survival is more important than principle. That's the bad part of the Iraqi population. The good part of the Iraqi population is that you still have a degree of credibility and dignity that is against occupation, against the designs of the imperialists and the Zionists also. You notice they speak about the American military presence in Iraq, and no one speaks about the Israeli military presence in Iraq. Can anyone believe that the American military has gone into Iraq and the Israelis are not with them? Of course they are. So there's opposition, there's a struggle, there's a fight, and there is a war against this, and this is the good part of the Iraqi population. We hope, we think, and we pray that as these events polarize, the more they do polarize, the more evident it's going to become to the average person who may be confused that there's a side to be condemned, whoever they are. No madhab is going to camouflage them. And there's a side that is to be honored. And those are the ones who are giving their lives to get rid of this American occupation. And eventually, that's what's going to happen. In human history, there's never been an occupying power that went thousands of miles across the globe, occupied a country, and remained there. And the United States of America is not going to be the exception to this historical social law. The day is going to come, the United States Army and armed forces are going to have to pack, and they're going to have to leave. And at that time, the honorable part of the Iraqi population that has been baptized in its resistance and in its struggle against that invasion and occupation will emerge, hopefully, and with Allah's provision, as the dominant force in Iraqi society.
Assalamu alaikum. I would just like to hear your thoughts about the upcoming elections and who do you think might be the person in Washington, and also what would you say the next 4 years would be like after that?
Imam. Imam, please address Obama because he drives me nuts also.
You know, it's easier to answer that question because there's two now that are competing. Just a few weeks ago, there were three who were competing. And the way it looks right now is that Obama is going to become the next president of the United States unless a couple of things may happen. The first thing is that the dark departments of the intelligence agencies, the CIA or Mossad or National Security Agency or whomever, they present us with something equivalent to 9/11. This could be some type of radioactive or small nuclear device that goes off in a major city in the United States, or it could be the poisoning of a water system in a metropolitan area in the United States, and you have thousands of American casualties, and then the media plays this whole thing out as it played 9/11 out, but now to another magnitude, and there's an air of jingoism, and people rally around the flag, and then they vote McCain as president of the United States, saying that the Bush policies have to continue. There's a real and clear danger to the United States, and we have to continue this course. That could do it. That could tip the balances against Obama. Another thing that could tip the balances against Obama is if the special forces of the United States find Osama bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri or both of them, and maybe a scattered few around them. They find them, they capture them, and then they bring them to the United States and put them on a trial that will continue for weeks to once again drum up this false patriotic feeling of the American people to give McCain the vote so that he will win the presidency of the United States, or some scenario equivalent to that. Now, if this is not going to happen, then you can almost rest assured that Obama is going to be the next occupant of the White House. You can almost blindly see it coming. And the reason Obama is selected to be the next president of the United States is basically because these elections, the first Tuesday in November, these elections are no longer American elections. These are global elections. The global interest dictates that there has to be a black man in the White House so that 4 years into the future, serious American policies have to be implemented, and they can only be implemented with an American president of African descent in the White House, especially if this person has that name, Barack Hussein Obama. Now, look at what the United States did when it had two other black figures in the State Department, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. We had Afghanistan and Iraq, we had 9/11, we had all of this crazy stuff, and they were only in the State Department. Imagine if a black person was in the White House, what they have planned. Talk about war against Sudan, talk about war against Iran. All of those can only be prosecuted safely with someone like Barack Obama as the chief executive of the United States government. Otherwise, they can't get away with very serious wars against China in Africa and against Islam in the Muslim hemisphere, because American public opinion simply won't take it. Imagine McCain in the White House, And imagine the United States military going to a draft system. And now everyone who's between age 18 and 26 is going to be drafted in the U.S. military. And, of course, there will be exceptions. But the only ones who can make those exceptions are the rich people. And the rich people are the Anglo or the Euro-Americans. They'll find ways and loopholes not to go to the service. And the brunt of it is going to be on the minorities, especially the African-American minority. And imagine sending 200,000 African-Americans to fight in Africa when McCain is in the White House. Oh, no, that's not going to work. But it may work. There's a good possibility that it will work if the man in the White House is black and is African. They'll say, oh, man, the brother in the White House, he knows better than me. You know, we'll do this war. We can go through it. So it'll bring a sense of cohesion in a racial society like the United States between whites and blacks because that man's in the White House. So they need him. Global policy needs that type of person in the White House. And this thing about, I really don't believe any longer that there's an honest count of the American vote. Right now with these computers and Diebold and manipulating the vote and the back room access to the computer and all of this stuff, they can skew the results of the election any way they want it. So even if Barack Obama doesn't get most of the votes, there's a ways of securing that he can get most of the votes. The electronic votes have made it very easy for a person like that to be elected. So down the road, brace yourselves. This is what's going to happen. I feel sorry for some of the Muslims, especially the African-American Muslims, who think that the presence of this person in the White House is going to be a relief for the Muslims and for the minorities and for the third world and for Africans. And to the contrary, this is the biggest show in town. And this is one of the other reasons why that title, Shaitan al-Akbar, applies very well to these regime makers in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Salaam alaikum. You used in answer, in response, your last response, you used the word selected. Would you please elaborate a little bit on whom do you think this group that apparently, if I understood it correctly, who meet in the back door and decide who the next president will be, who do you think these groups are or personalities?
To jump to the answer very quickly, this is the big business, the big money, the transnational corporations, the CEOs, the elites of the world who plan and execute decisions of this magnitude. The United States is no longer, I wish that was the case, it appears to be the case in the phony media out there, that the American people are electing their president. It's not the American people who are electing their president. American people go to the election booth, they choose the choice from the list that they have, but when the counting is finally done, it is done on the terms that will serve these elites, these bigwigs, some of them lodged into the government itself, the American government. Some of them lodged into European governments. Some of them are in the World Bank. Some of them are in the International Monetary Fund. And some of them, they just remain, they are so entrenched in the capitalist positions that they are in that they remain anonymous and unknown. They do have a yearly meeting, at least an important segment of them. They're called the Bilderbergs. This year, it was outside of Washington, D.C. As a matter of fact, it was just last week that they met in Chantilly in Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C. But they have this yearly meeting, and they have personnel who attend it. Bill Clinton, he was an unknown figure. After attending that meeting, all of a sudden he became president of the United States. And so these are the movers and the shakers when it comes to deciding who's going to get all this money to become president of the United States. Barack Obama certainly doesn't have the background and the connections to get all of this money, but they launched him into their club, so to speak. He's become more or less one of them, and now they're moving him. Why is he getting all of this money, getting more than any other candidate? Because obviously, these are, once again, elites. These are the people who have the money. They can finance his campaign. They can present him in a favorable light in the media. And they can make of him the leader of the United States, and potentially from there, the rest of the world, if they can get away with this.
Okay, last question. Do I get the last question? Okay.
Imam Alassi, I have a question. Do you have any idea about the situation in Pakistan? The American attacks on Pakistan, as well as the political situation there and all that, what's going on?
Well, Pakistan, because it's a Muslim country, obviously is not dear to the United States. They'd prefer to fragment Pakistan if they can do that on their terms. Pakistan right now, I guess, the government that is there is serving the American interest, so the government has been surviving, even though there's been opposition to it. You ask, you know, I'm not a person who follows Pakistani internal politics closely, but from my view of things, I think that there may be a plan, a very serious plan, to bring about a disintegration of Pakistan. It could be along ethnic lines, it could be along sectarian lines, it could be along both of the, whatever serves the purpose. It could very well begin with this hunt for Taliban and Qaeda in Pakistan. I don't know if you've heard. Had anyone heard that before her assassination, Benazir Bhutto, there was an interview on Al Jazeera English TV with David Frost? Did anyone hear about that? No one heard about it. We talk about YouTube. Someone mentioned this earlier. You can go to YouTube and Google someone's name and look at what they said. Do this. Go to YouTube and look up Benazir Bhutto and David Frost. And you'll see an interview that he had with her, I think it was in October. She was assassinated, December 27th or something. So this was about 2.5 months before that, this interview took place. And listen to this. In the interview, she says that she mentioned some of these Taliban types, radicals who are running around. Some of them were actually British agents. But anyways, she mentions the name of the... I can't remember at this point. But she mentions the name of the person who killed Osama bin Laden. Now, you'd think when someone like that says something like that, David Frost, who's, you know, very well known for his interviews, is like, you know, he's, wait a minute, did I hear you right? Did you say so-and-so who assassinated Osama bin Laden? Nothing. They didn't stop him. Because, you know, these interviewers, they have an earpiece. And they have their managers back there probably in the earpiece saying to him, forget that she said that. Just keep on going, as ignore it. Because he just professionally ignored what she said. I mean, that's an eye popper. What? Are you? What did you say? No, no, nothing. And then Al Jazeera, it has what she said written down. But no, there's no comment, no follow-up, no wait, nothing at all. So, which means, you know, what is going on in Pakistan is very deep. Something is going on there. And may Allah, you know, help the people who are there, the oppressed and the Muslims and the hopeless and the powerless. May Allah protect them from all of these schemings. I mean, just an interview like that tells you that, I mean, they're trying to cover up something very, very serious. So, any of you have access to the internet, especially if you're from Pakistan, when you go back, go to YouTube and Google that and listen to what she says and listen to it very closely. It's going to shock you.
Do you want to ask a question? Are you sure? Well, okay. Well, one last question for Brother Ali Gunje. I'm partial to him.
Assalamu alaikum. There are a couple of things I have been heard. I am kind of listening to public broadcasting a lot. There's not because I liked a session, but there's a lot of things you can get off of it. And a couple of things was, I heard, one of them was, about a few months back, they were talking that was a CIA agent on the things, and he was talking right now for United States to ignore Ayatollah Khamenei. They have to go, actually that's about a year, year and a half ago, they have to go see Ayatollah Muntazari. And then the next day, I heard from Iranian TV, German ambassador went to come to visit Ayatollah Muntazari. And there are some other things which they say we have to compromise with the Muslim moderate for destruction of the Muslim conservative. And it was about a year and a half or 2 years ago, they were talking about the how did they were able to defeat a Spanish Muslim by going after the moderate for destruction of the conservative. Do you have any idea on those, please?
Yeah, there was a study by the RAND Corporation. It was done by the wife of this Khalil Zad, who used to be the Afghani, the American ambassador to Afghanistan. Now he's... I don't know where he is. He went through the United Nations, and then, and there's word that he might be considering that. Yeah, that's going back and forth. So, anyways, his wife has written a report for the RAND Corporation in which she categorizes Muslims as fundamentalists, and then traditional and then moderate and then, I don't know, secular or whatever. I can't remember in detail. But anyways, they're looking at Muslims and they want to see how they can support the less radical against the more radical, or the more moderate against the less moderate. And this only reinforces, you know, a shaitan al-akbar idea about them. Can you imagine Muslims thinking out a program looking at Christians and Jews as more moderate and less moderate, and we should support the more moderate against the radicals and do these types of things? But this is what they are actively doing. It goes back to the presentation that we gave and how, you know, evil their thoughts are. How they are, you give them a few inches, they want to take 1,000 miles from you. And what the, you know, the examples that you gave pertaining to Imam Khamenei and Ayatollah Muntaviri, once again, here they are. They're trying to play their game. Who's interfering in their internal politics? Certainly we're not. So what gives them the right to interfere in Islamic internal politics? They give the right to themselves. They take the right from whoever they want, and they give the right to whomever they want. This is how they've been operating. So thank you for the comment that substantiates what we've been saying all along.
I feel very inadequate, but I can just say thank you for coming. Thank you for your presence, and may Allah bless you and protect you, inshallah. Imam Al-Asi has completed the first volume of his tafsir, the Ascendant Quran, and I've read some of his tafsir earlier in the Crescent International, and it is very interesting stuff, highly recommended. Imam Al-Asi, thank you so much. May Allah bless you.
This particular volume that has been printed, it just came off the press about 3 weeks ago, 23 days ago. It came off the press. It covers Surah Al-Fatiha to the 141st ayah of Surah Al-Baqarah. That's the first juz of the Qur'an. I'm finishing the 9th juz of the Qur'an right now. So the printing end of this is lagging behind. The hope is that every 6 months there will be another volume coming out. And I think we're going to try our best to have it available in good numbers at the Muslim Congress here in Dallas on the 5th and 6th of this, 4th, 5th, and 6th of July. So if you're interested in obtaining one, please come to the conference. If for some reason you want it to have it before the conference, you can always contact Crescent International, and they will send you a copy.
You can get a signed copy?
Yes, I'll be at the Muslim conference. You want me to sign it? Actually, yesterday Imam Musa had a program, and I was there at the masjid, and I was signing. And sometimes, you know, you put a challenge on these fingers, it becomes very challenging. 80, 90 people come within a span of an hour or two and you're signing. But I'm willing to do it, alhamdulillah. You know, we're all brothers, sure.
Again, Imam Al-Asi, may Allah protect you, may Allah keep you, may Allah keep you in good health, and may we have many more opportunities to enlighten ourselves from you, inshallah. Thank you.